You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Michael Grunwald of Time Magazine, on his latest piece, One Nation on Welfare, Living Your Life on the Dole. You are all lazy. You are all moochers and takers and parasites. I'm one too, I guess. We are all just wretched human beings. Wretched. Of course not Mitt Romney. But the rest of you, and me, and us, we're all dirty, so dirty. Also on the program today, Democratic enthusiasm seems to be way, way up. Tim Pawlenty, not so much, or I should say, not so much when it comes to electoral politics. Update on the NAA. The NDAA. We'll get to that. More on Pennsylvania voters. 47% victimology. It continues on and on. It's the election season, folks. Deal with it for another 5 or 6 weeks, I guess. We'll talk about a story about somebody who couldn't deal with it later in the program. But I am still catching up from last week. So let me just weigh into this. Last week, you will recall that we had an attorney on this program over the summer who was representing some journalists, including Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges, in attempting to enjoin the implementation of specific sections of the National Defense Authorization Act, which would allow the federal government to indefinitely detain, well, anyone. I mean, that was part of the problem, is that it was so broad that it would ensnare journalists simply interviewing anyone who might be in any way associated or helpful or in some way related to someone who is a terrorist. And that definition of terrorist was also equally broad. So on Wednesday of last week, U.S. District Judge Catherine Forrest, who had issued a preliminary injunction, I guess it was back in May, sided with the NDAA opponents, said that the act was too vague, violates the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, and wrote, courts must safeguard core constitutional rights. While the Supreme Court has sanctioned undue deference to the executive and legislative branches on these questions, constitutional questions, those cases are generally now considered an embarrassment when that has happened. She permanently enjoined the implementation of specific sections of the law. 1201, I believe it was. I don't know. Don't quote me on that. Can't remember exactly what the words. However, on Monday, New York federal judge Raymond Lohier granted an emergency stay to the enjoining of that law. So essentially an emergency stay on the ruling of Catherine B. Forrest, which will temporarily block that ruling. The Obama administration had appealed the injunction. Not terribly surprising that there was a stay issued on that holding. It's unclear why the judge issued that stay. And what the next step will be will probably be a hearing, or at least by the appellate judge. So just to get you updated on that, I was out the beginning of the week, and apparently none of those judges felt it appropriate to wait for my return. To be fair, we did not issue any type of motion to that effect. So I fired my attorneys, and we'll deal with that next time in the future. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Grunwald.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop blow. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink, and her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Michael Grunwald. He is the senior national correspondent for Time Magazine. He is author of the very recently released New Deal, which is a really comprehensive, I don't know if there's been that many accountings of specific legislation like this before. The reporting on it is just great. So I can't recommend that enough. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hey, thanks so much, Sam.
And I specifically want to talk about this piece in Time Magazine that you wrote, which I have to say, I want to congratulate you because I think it's the first time that I have read Time Magazine in an exceptionally long time.
You don't go to the dentist?
I well, I hope you enjoyed your time there at Time Magazine. Well, I do go to the dentist, yes, and indeed I do pick it up there, but, you know.
I joke. I kid.
Of course, of course, of course. No, I know that many people pick up Time Magazine in other venues. When I go to the dentist, I have to say it's the one time I sort of like dip into the People magazines to actually see just exactly how out of touch I am with everything that's going on in the entertainment world. But be that as it may, I went and I actually picked up Time Magazine to read this piece, and it is a great piece. It basically, well, you characterize it. You walk through one of your normal days and just point out how incredibly subsidized you are. And I guess presumably the rest of us.
Exactly. I mean, that was really, really the idea. Was I had been hearing all this sort of makers and takers talk. And as you know, Sam, that in fact, you know, if you work, you're a maker. That this notion that, you know, 47% of the country doesn't pay taxes is bogus. I'm sure you've discussed that a lot, that, you know, maybe they don't pay what is called income taxes, but they do pay payroll taxes and sales taxes and gas taxes and all kinds of other taxes. But I wanted to look at the takers part too, because it turns out, you know, we think of takers as just sort of poor people on welfare. Or, you know, sometimes maybe even like kind of corporate welfare, you think of that kind kind of thing, but just sort of regular people with jobs, you know, we're takers too, particularly through the tax code. I talked about how I wake up in subsidized housing because I have a mortgage interest deduction on my house. You know, my savings through 401ks, that's tax deferred. My health care, I get the tax exclusion because it's employer provided health care. And I tried to sort of go through my day and show how my water that I use, my electricity I use, the tennis courts where I play on, this is all kind of government largesse that people like to complain about so much.
Yeah, and I don't think you make the point of when we talk about federal government spending money, just lay out for us. I mean, I know we talked about it on this program, but the only way these sort of silly memes survive, I think, about, 47% or the idea that that we are all, I mean, the fact of the matter is, we are all essentially getting stuff from society, and the government chooses winners and losers every time we engage in almost any behavior, because it has different, you've outlined, different treatment in terms of what activities will and will not be taxed, what circumstances in which you will be taxed, how much you will or will not be taxed based upon your income. So just, I mean, lay out for us exactly sort of what federal expenditures amount to, and just so that people get a notion of what we spend our money on and what the difference is. I mean, you lay this out quite succinctly and clearly. How much we spend, how much we take in, and how much more we would take in if we didn't, I don't want to say randomly, because in some instances it's not, but if we didn't decide, some people are going to get preferential tax treatment.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we have this debate going on about big government in this country, and it's almost entirely detached from the reality of big government. One of the things I do talk about in the book about some of the kind of boondoggles that I benefit from, and that others benefit from, the farm subsidies, the environmentally destructive sprawl roads. There are all kinds of, I do sort of make a kind of implicit case that government does try to do too many things, but the actual where the money goes is essentially on stuff that people like. The government spends right now about $3.5 trillion a year. The vast majority of it is for defense, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which is health care for the elderly and the poor, but also nursing homes and the disabled. That's really, the sort of non-defense discretionary spending, which is sort of Washingtonese for everything else, which is, the FBI and, the guys who make sure that your food isn't contaminated and you name it. That's only 12% of the budget. And then on top of that $3.5 trillion, you have another $1.3 trillion in tax expenditures, which is something that politicians like because they're just like spending programs, except they're done through the tax code. So instead of getting attacked as being a big spender, you get to brag about how you're cutting taxes because instead the money just never reaches the Treasury in the first place. And those are things like the mortgage deduction, the deduction I get for my nanny, the favorable tax treatment for savings like in a 401k, Mitt Romney getting his favorable carried interest for some of those hedge fund guys. The business expenses I get because I'm an author, right? So I get to write off a lot of the work that I do, and I have personal expenses that are of a business nature. I can write that off. Then, that's like Mitt Romney's dressage costs. I mean, there are all kinds of, they cost the government money, but it's not considered spending because the government never got the money in the first place. But so that's about another, 25 to 30% of where government money goes.
Right. I mean, if we had we should be clear about this because, this concept of tax expenditures, there's been very little written about this. I mean, we spoke to Susan Mettler when her book came out, and I think her piece in the I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly, but her book came out, I think it was last fall. And this concept of tax expenditures is one which I think people have a tough time grasping. We need, obviously, to run a certain amount of services. Now, we can, like you say, I think in your piece, that we can argue as to whether or not there are inefficiencies or certain things that government should or should not be doing. But we need, everyone agrees we need to take in taxes. We set up a tax code, and then we start to carve things out of it. I think that there are some on the ideological spectrum who don't accept the concept of tax expenditures. You know, this idea of like, well, it's not your money anyways, so if you just don't get it, how does that cost anything? But, you know, the idea is that we need these services are all demanded by people.
Exactly. And they're no different from spending programs, except that they're in the tax code and administered by the IRS. And there's one other big difference, which is that they are hugely regressive. Because remember, you're getting a tax break on your income taxes. And as we've been hearing about this week, there are very different income tax rates for people with very different income. So if you have a very high income and a very expensive house, the mortgage deduction is a really, you know, you're making a lot. It's a huge deal for you. While if you have a very small income and a very small house, you're getting a much smaller percentage deduction on a much smaller, the smaller nut, right? So it really is, it's one of the things that, you know, if you just gave everybody money for childcare, it would mean, you know, presumably everybody would get the same amount, or, you know, like other entitlement programs, and it would mean more to people with less income. But when you do it through the tax code, it means more to people with more income. Like a janitor can maybe deduct 1/6 of his mortgage income interest, while Mitt Romney is deducting 1/3.
I mean, there's an argument there that if we did not provide some type of tax benefit to employer-based healthcare, that we would not only be driving to, and then instead provided it by government subsidy, we would be driving down the cost of healthcare in that regard. Now, I happen to be one of those people who sort of feel that we don't want to force decisions to be made on healthcare based upon money from the demand side, because I just don't think that patients are really like consumers. It's a slightly different business, but the economic dynamic is the same.
Right. Well, you know, I would probably, you know, argue with a little bit at the margins about that, where you do want, you know, there may be some skin in the game advantages that I talked about in the story, when it came to I had a shoulder injury and I was, dealing with some physical therapy, and there were some questions about, you know, because these tax incentives, they are incentives. You tend to consume more of these things that it's tax advantageous to consume. And so, you know, I think my doctor was probably a lot more willing to assign a whole bunch of expensive tests. But that said, I was probably a lot more willing to get the physical therapy that ended up saving me from surgery. I think the larger point is that these are incentives for, you know what, I'm going to have healthcare no matter what. I'm lucky. I have a good job and my wife works too. I am going to save money. I am going to have a nanny. There are all these incentives for people who are not poor or anywhere close to poor to do things that they would probably do anyway. And $1.3 trillion a year, that's a lot of money. So as we're having this debate over, you know, our long-term fiscal sustainability, I think there's a real question whether we can afford to be letting, you know, billionaires deduct their mortgage interest on their second home, right? I mean, and so there will be, hopefully be, you know, when I went to the Cato Institute And I went to the Liberal Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and talked to them like, you know, well, where would you start cutting? They both started with agriculture subsidies. But after that, they both talked about, you know, maybe we need to rein in some of these tax expenditures, particularly the home mortgage one for rich people.
And traditionally, I mean, tax expenditures, I mean, obviously it has a really big appeal to politicians of both parties because, you know, passing a tax cut in some way seems to be the easiest thing in the world. And though it ends up being an expenditure in the context of the our bottom line in terms of our budget, it is a far easier thing to sort of marshal through. It's also been historically a Republican mechanism as opposed to what has been considered historically a Democratic mechanism in terms of Democrats have traditionally more looked for direct subsidies, I guess, in certain areas rather than providing a tax break. I mean, more or less, is that the case?
Well, in recent history, it's been a pretty bipartisan mechanism. Right. The problem, though, is that, you know, because of the Grover Norquist of the world, you know, once you've got it, it's impossible to repeal it because that's a tax increase, right? And that's been and that, I think, is a real problem. And it does set up this larger issue that I think, you know, this whole hubbub over what Mitt Romney has been saying really does get at, is that we have this country of people who are, you know, who really are makers and takers. But we're sort of very proud of our making and we're completely blind to our taking. And when we hear about these freeloaders and moochers, we assume they're talking about somebody else because I'm not, right? I'm not a freeloader or moocher. I'm a maker. It's those other takers. And so it's really, I think, sort of toxic, to the, you know, the sort of body politic, this notion where we're sort of, you have these politicians who are sort of flattering us and telling us, you know, you're the maker, but there's somebody else out there who's the taker, when in fact we're all doing both.
And so really what we're talking about is there's another perspective in which look at it. Now, I know this is sort of this is heresy in this country, but when we're talking that we're all makers and takers, what we're also saying is that government serves to redistribute money. I mean, right? I mean, it's basically taking resources from one area and saying it is more beneficial to society to invest them in other areas.
Right. And, you know, and I think there ought to be a debate about where some of that money is being redistributed, right? Whether it's being distributed up, whether it's being distributed down, whether it's being distributed to agriculture or manufacturing. You know, these are always decisions that we've made, right? It's not this new thing that, you know, that people pay taxes and it goes to public services, that not everybody enjoys. I mean, there's some, you know, national defense we all pretty much benefit from equally and my local taxes that go to pay cops, and pick up the trash. I mean, pretty much everybody gets their public safety and their trash pickup. But, you know, when you start to get to, you know, the public tennis courts, you know, I love them. You know, I play a lot of tennis. There are other people who don't get those. But then there are, you know, there are public schools and there are kids, there are families in Miami Beach who don't have children in the schools. So there are lots of decisions we make as a society that ought to be debated about where that we're all going to be makers and we're all going to be contributing to the upkeep of our society. And it's appropriate for us to decide what the public benefits are going to be. You know, what I tried to show in the article is that debate doesn't happen because so many of these benefits are invisible, and they're certainly not to the sort of people who you feel are really kind of needing of government help.
Well, what do you make of this? I mean, because I definitely agree with the idea that there are plenty of arguments to be had as to who benefits from what in terms of the way that the money is redistributed. I think there's even arguments in terms of who gets the most benefit from the police, who gets the most benefit
right.
from the military. I mean, I think there's definitely arguments to be made there. But why do you think it is that we have a body politic now that where the question of that redistribution happens? I mean, it seems to me that arguing over whether or not redistribution happens not how it happens, but whether it happens, is like arguing the concept of whether or not we're breathing oxygen. It is the fundamental bedrock principle of the existence of government, which is that, but yet that seems to be in contention in some respects.
But in a way, I think you've sort of answered your own question, right? I mean, and the whole argument about, you know, where Mitt Romney says, you know, it's not, you know, essentially has nothing good to say about government. Now, I don't think any of us actually believe that if Mitt Romney was president, he would immediately eliminate the U.S. government. But it's just these are code words for essentially saying, you know, it's really the same kind of maker and taker argument all over again. It's a way of trying to tell voters that, you know, that essentially that Obama stands for taking your money and giving it to somebody who doesn't deserve it. You know, that's I don't know if that's a harsh way of putting it, but I do think that's what the, you know, you saw when you pulled back the curtain and saw him at that fundraiser. That really is the implicit message. And I think when you start digging up a 16-year-old tape of Obama talking about redistribution, to suggest that that's how he might govern as president, when in fact we have a pretty good 4-year record where you can look at how he might govern as president, you could point to that sort of redistribution. I think it makes it pretty clear that they're trying to tap into certain kind of cultural biases and buzzwords as opposed to making an actual argument about, you know, look, Medicare is redistribution, right? And you know, according to Mitt Romney, Obama's the one trying to destroy it.
Well, everything is redistribution. I mean, everything the government does. I mean, that's the thing that from your perspective, you're a senior national correspondent for Time Magazine. How is it that we are now at that place where the idea, of course, he's talking about redistribution because that's what government's central function is, right? I mean, we're going to redistribute, even if I'm the most libertarian, well, not the most libertarian, you'd be surprised at where that ends up, conversations I've had on this program, people have called in, but even if I am sort of the, a fairly libertarian perspective, I'm still talking about government redistributing wealth, right? I mean, it's taking my money in the form of taxes and putting it towards the military. Well, okay.
Well, I guess, Sam, you know, and if you'll excuse the plug, you know, like, you read my book.
Indeed.
And the New Deal, I did write, I guess the good news is that I don't think the people who are making these arguments actually believe them. I think it is purely cynical. And certainly the Republicans, I sort of describe how, you know, for instance, with the stimulus bill that I wrote about, I mean, while describing stimulus as, you know, as Sharia socialism and the death of American free enterprise, because Obama wanted to spend $787 billion, the Republicans were also supporting a $715 billion stimulus that was almost identical. And, you know, Paul Ryan voted for that one. Mitt Romney, of all the 2008 presidential candidates, supported the biggest stimulus. So I do think that this is just, this is not a real, there's not a real substantive debate. It's not like Mitt Romney thinks that, you know, that somehow, you know, that 47% of the country is getting over on him. I think it's the larger point, I think, is that there are all kinds of benefits. Some of them are benefits to people who hide their money in the Cayman Islands and Switzerland, and some of them are benefits for people who are working poor and get an earned income tax credit so that they don't have any what's called income tax liability, even though they have to pay Social Security taxes. And those, I think, are sort of legitimate debates. But, you know, we have a very stupid political culture, I'm sorry to say, and, you know, and a media that's not very interested in public policy, and a, you know, one party that right now is really interested in sort of tearing down government and the other party that's not overly interested in defending it. I think you get this kind of distortion.
Right. And we should say that just in the fact that we talk about the stimulus as being $770 billion some odd dollars, we're including in that one third of which nearly is tax expenditures. So when we talk about the size of that, how much it cost, we don't differentiate between what are tax expenditures and actual redistribution of a sort of active transfer of money from government.
That's right. And in fact, that was one of the first fights that Obama had with the Republicans, was over the notion that some of those tax expenditures were, like increasing the earned income tax credit, were really in the stimulus, were aimed at low-income people. And the Republicans were very upfront about it. They did not consider those tax cuts. They considered that welfare spending. And they actually, in fact, there's a sort of famous moment, though people forget what they were discussing, where it was the fourth day of Obama's presidency, and he invited a bunch of congressional leaders, and Obama got into a tussle with Eric Cantor, and he said, "Well, look, Eric, elections have consequences, and I won." People remember that moment. They don't remember that, in fact, what they were arguing about was tax expenditures, where Cantor was saying, like, "Oh, you can't consider those tax cuts." Republicans had asked for $300 billion in tax cuts. Obama came up with $300 billion in tax cuts, but then they didn't like them because some of them went to poor people.
Right. And really, fundamentally, there's no operative, I mean, it is all, I guess, sort of personal taste in some respect as to the difference between an earned income deduction and the difference between regular federal income tax and capital gains, at least, you know, in 80 some odd percent of the circumstances, because we're simply talking about getting your income from interest returns on stock, as opposed to I'm getting it because based upon other work that I did.
I mean, it's one reason that it really is kind of shocking that the Republicans would put up Mitt Romney, because he's such an excellent example of this. I mean, the dude has not had a job in 6 years, right? I mean, he's making a lot of money, and he's paying an extremely low tax rate, way lower than middle income people who go to work every day and just pay their Social Security and payroll taxes and their Medicare taxes and their maybe a small income or even no income taxes, but they're paying their gas taxes. And I mean, they're paying a lot bigger chunk of their income than Mitt Romney is. And that guy doesn't even work.
Yeah. He's getting a 20% discount on his taxes.
Carried interest deduction, which is that huge scam for a lot of Wall Street guys who, you know, but again, you can't get rid of that because that's raising taxes.
All right, I want to ask a question that you raised briefly in your piece, and it's slightly off topic, but I'm interested in this concept, so that, you know, there are some who say that the idea of this came up with Rand Paul last weekend, I guess it was, or 2 weekends ago, where he was, he was arguing about the reduction in government workers across the board. Now, we have seen, right, I believe, an increase in federal workforce, I think a lot of which comes to the military. But overall, we're talking about a reduction of at least 600,000 government workers. Municipal, state, I guess that's the sound that means that is exactly the right number.
No, sorry.
Are you making tea?
No, that's my other line. It's ringing, but I'm sorry about that.
That is an amazingly loud phone. The point being that when we talk about the reduction in workers, we're talking about state, municipal, and county, I guess, officials. What role does the federal government play in maintaining those positions in any given time? Has there ever been a time where federal funds didn't in some way support teachers, cops, firemen, all of those?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of federal programs that provide aid to states, but there was a, you know, I'm a hammer and the whole world looks like a nail. So it's always about the stimulus for me.
Right.
But that was a real moment where state and local jobs were just hemorrhaging. They're losing hundreds of thousands because most states have balanced budget requirements. And after the financial collapse of 2008, revenues were just plummeting because people were getting laid off and businesses had no profits. So there was a time where, you know, they were just, there are really millions of public jobs at risk, and the stimulus provided nearly $200 billion in aid to states that governors used to sort of balance their budgets without shredding their workforces. Of course, many of those same governors then turned around and yelled at Congress and the president for not balancing their budget. They were happy to complain about the profligate federal government, but they took the cash, every single one of them. But you're absolutely right. After a big expansion of government workers during the Bush era, when private sector growth was incredibly tepid, in the Obama era, after that first year, you've actually had a decrease in public sector workforce, while there's been pretty, not good, but at least some private sector growth. And if you hadn't had that private sector destruction, the public sector destruction, unemployment would probably be a point lower than it is right now.
Right. And I know that relative to other recessionary times, but I mean, even in what we consider sort of normal times, federal government has always played a role in maintaining at least some of those state jobs, right? I mean, I guess it's money is, fungible in some sense. I mean, if the
exactly. Sure. I mean, the federal government pays more than half of Medicaid. The federal government provides all kinds of aid to states for education, for public safety, just about everything that states and locals do. In fact, I didn't put this in the article, but there is. I interview my mayor, and while I was sitting in her office, her CFO walked in, and she had to sign off. And he sort of was shoving these papers in front of her and said, sign here, sign here, sign here. And she was like, well, wait, what do I have to sign? And what it turned out that it was she had just had to sign papers to get, I think it was like $1.8 billion in federal money. I don't even remember what it was for. It was sort of like, this quarter's federal check. So she was like, oh, I guess I better sign that. But the federal government is very big, and it does a lot of things, and that's and it has the kind of SWAT that states and locals do. So it really does. It certainly does support the workforce as well as the services.
Indeed. Well, Michael Grunwald, I want to highly recommend that the next time people are in the dentist office or in the and they're going to see the doctor, they pick up.
We
time
have millions of subscribers, Sam. I just want you to know we are.
Based on what you said, buddy.
Rick, if you're listening,
we can search out his IP and make sure he doesn't. No one associated at Time Magazine gets this. All right. Well, Michael Grunwald, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks so much, Sam. Appreciate it.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick musical interlude just to show you that we've been upgrading the music. And that Matt's not sleeping at the wheel. When we come back, we will be talking about, I got to say, this is one of the funniest stories I've heard in a long time. Tim Pawlenty. Well, I won't ruin it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Just so excited about having some new songs in the rotation. Just had to take that break. Um, We'll get to this Tim Pawlenty thing because it's just too fantastic. You all remember who Tim Pawlenty is, right? He was, I guess about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, people thought that he was going to be the nominee. And then I think about a year ago, people thought that maybe he'd be the VP. Tim Pawlenty, a former governor of Minnesota.
Just a few T-Paw. Weeks ago, I thought he was trying out to be a stand-up comic on the at the Republican National Convention.
Right, he was very funny. I didn't see it. T-Paw, he got rid of his mullet. Didn't he have a mullet at one point? And to make himself more palatable, nationally speaking, I don't know what's wrong with the mullet, but whatever. So Tim Pawlenty, named to be one of the co-chairs of Mitt Romney's campaign. Now, my guess is there's probably about 50 co-chairs across the country. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less. This isn't, you're not literally running the campaign, but you're out there. You're an important surrogate. And Tim Pawlenty has certainly been out there. We are now 6 weeks away, maybe seven, from the vote. This is crunch time, people. This is the time where you want your co-chairs to go out there. This is the time where you want them to go out there and pound the pavement for you. And, of course, so Tim Pawlenty announced today that, he's going to have to quit his job as co-chair of the Mitt Romney campaign. Why? Because he's taking a new job, CEO of the Financial Services Roundtable. What is the Financial Services Roundtable? It is one of the most prominent, basically, bank, financier, Wall Street trade associations that are lobbying regulators to water down the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform law. This is one of those guys, one of those institutions that go and pound the government so that bankers do not have any restrictions. And 6 to 7 weeks out from the campaign, Pawlenty has to quit his job as co-chair. You just imagine what's going on in that that job interview. Tim, we're prepared to give you the job. You know, actually, I've got this other thing that I'm committed to until November. You know what? F it. Forget it. I can do this. Yeah, let's start. I'll start tomorrow. Are you sure, Tim? Because if you need a little time. No. Forget it. I get parking, right, with this? You get parking, and can I find out what's on the...
And that other gig isn't going anywhere.
Nah, I don't give a... I mean, honestly, that guy's a... They had promised me I was going to have a different job anyways. I was like, forget them. So they're just horrible to work for. I'm happy to leave them. Don't you need to give them 3 weeks' notice? Nah. I mean, maybe. I don't care. Honestly, I really don't care. Now, here's the best thing. Well, I don't know if that's not the best thing. But here's Tim Pawlenty. Now, granted, this is almost 15 months ago, speaking to the Faith and Freedom Coalition event, thousands of Christians, when I think at the time he was applying for a different job than head of one of the largest lobbying firms on behalf of the banks, who are literally, you might say, they're heading to the trough that is the American government and drinking out of it. He is now the CEO of that institution. Here's what he had to say to the Christians just 15 months ago. Here it is.
And then I went to Wall Street and told them to get their snout out of the trough because they're some of the worst offenders when it comes to bailouts and carve-outs and special deals.
Wow. So I guess what Tim Pawlenty is saying, I mean, this is the shorter Tim Pawlenty. One is get your troughs out and let me show you how to lead that back in to that trough. And two is Mitt Romney can go F himself. He ain't going to be president. That ain't happening. So I'm heading over to that bigger trough. So congratulations, Tim Pawlenty. And glad to see you basically tell those guys to F off. Couldn't happen to a better group of people than the Romney campaign. We're going to take a break and head into the better half of the program. I've got a lot of sound for you. The guy who was pushing the Pennsylvania voter ID law took, he got his bigotry stuck in the middle of his other bigotry, sort of like a Reese's peanut butter cup of just disdain and hatred. More clips of Mitt Romney from that speech that have not gotten the attention that I think that they have deserved. You've all heard the fact that he thinks that 47% of you are moochers. In fact, this is so prominent. Mitt Romney's such a bad candidate. I think we're seeing this in just about every metric possible for Americans. We'll talk about that in the program as well. I'm talking about ranging from polling to cable TV ratings to the first thing that the UPS guy said to me when he walked into the door today. Literally, he was just like, "You guys part of the 47%? So we'll play some of those clips in the better half of the program. And a couple other stories we have for you as well, including Todd Akin's family's obsession with rape in one form or another. And also an update on that pepper spraying cop from UC Davis. Unbelievable. Folks, it is your support that funds 98% of the show. So when I get in the morning and we hear a hard drive whirring and whining, it is your membership that will pay for the new hard drive. Now, look, I don't want to say that 47% of you are parasites or freeloaders, because the figure is actually significantly higher. But unlike Mitt Romney, I believe that it takes a village. Now, yes, although I would say in this instance, we do really have one of those situations where theoretically there is a small percentage of you making this show available for a large percentage of you. And we here at the Majority Report also have made it very clear that we will subsidize your membership if you cannot afford it. You just need to email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com.
And if you feel bad even about that, I think we still have a few Strange Angels left.
We still have a few. Strange Angels is doing a free trial membership for 50 people this month of the Majority Report to promote their launching of their site.
Now, remember, those memberships are paid for by Strange Angels. So,
indeed.
So there you go.
There you go. And Strange Angels also having that event in Brooklyn on the 23rd. Go to strangeangels.com for more information about that. It is basically a human being controlled matchmaking online dating site, sort of. So we have all those opportunities. But for those of you who live in large and listening to the show, of course, I joke, you're freeloading. We know that we make the show free. But if you want to ensure that it shows up on your iPod or your Zune or your Palm Pilot or whatever it is that you listen to this program.
Whatever ancient technology says.
Yes, if you want to open up your CompuServe every morning and make sure that...
I believe we'll make it available on floppy disks for your Apple II.
Right. You've got a new podcast, whatever the... I don't know why I just sounded like Andy Kinley there, but... the way to ensure that that happens is to become a member. You can join today at majority.fm. Many other ways of supporting this program. But, of course, as we say, becoming a member is the most supportive of all. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, organic if you want it, chocolate, 10% discount, coupon code MAJORITY. You can get a majority.fm blend. We have swag. We also could use some iTunes reviews. The more you review it on iTunes, the more people listen, the more people become members, the more this thing becomes guaranteed source of income. As you know, Nikki, in the production world, very tentative, extremely tentative. Things are going to probably get more tentative as we go on. So the way you can ensure that I show up here every day, or 4 days a week, or I don't know, last week I guess, well, I mean, we still did programming, so a lot of people didn't even realize it. But so that there's programming here for you on a consistent basis is to support the show. And of course, if you buy crap through Amazon, we have our Amazon link. Doesn't cost you anything. Very easy to do. But it definitely helps us out. Cuts into our equipment expenses. If you have recently become a member, just give us a couple of days. We're catching up because poor Hillary, I saw her today. Her hand is in a full-on cast. Buy one of those safety can openers on through our Amazon link. I'm not kidding. She's out for 4 weeks. Unbelievable. All right, folks, join us in the better half. 646-257-3920 is the number, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM or majorityfm@jabber.org is also another IM if you're not using an AOL client. See you in the better half.